Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thank you very much for joining us today. And as a reminder to those that are with us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find a link to the chat room where you can roll in with some of the usual suspects. And that's a perfect place where if in the course of listening to the show, you have a point of order or a question you would like for us to ask our guest, and it doesn't look like we're heading in that direction, we'll be more than happy to steal your great ideas and make them our own. Also, if you're new to Midrats or you have to jump off halfway through the show and you want to find out what you've missed, you can always get the full archive for this show and previous ones over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can just take the shortcut and subscribe to the podcast over on iTunes. But hey, enough of that. Let's go ahead and get on with the show. And today's guest for the full hour is the editor of the third book from the U.S. Naval Institute's 21st Century Foundations grouping, 21st Century Ellis. And the editor is Captain B.A. Friedman, United States Marine Corps. Captain Friedman is a field artillery officer for the United States Marine Corps, of course, currently stationed in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. He's working on his master's degree in national security and strategic studies through the Naval War College. 21st Century Ellis, for those that aren't part of the Marine Corps fraternity and don't recognize the name, it covers much of the work of Lieutenant Colonel Earl Hancock, otherwise known as Pete Ellis, U.S. Marine Corps, who, kind of the gold star next to his name, back in 1921 made some pretty accurate predictions about the coming war with Japan. Collected together in this nice, handy little volume, like all three volumes are in the 21st Century Foundation series, includes a lot of his articles on counterinsurgency and conventional war based upon his experiences in World War I and also in the Philippines. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Brett. Welcome to Midrats.
Hi, Sal. Hi, Eagle One. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's great to have you this afternoon. And just to kind of, I think you outlined pretty good in the book that if you're part of the Marine Corps fraternity, worst case scenario, you've seen his name or heard his name mentioned once or twice, but outside of the Marine Corps, who is this guy, Lieutenant Colonel Pete Ellis, this 05, and from your perspective, what is significant about Ellis that he deserves to be included in the pantheon that we're building with Mahan and Sims?
Well, in the first place, Pete Ellis was he's basically a longtime serving Marine that was identified as particularly intellectual and thoughtful, especially autodidactic, a little bit. He was a voracious reader. And at different points in his career, senior officers identified him as such an individual and put him to work for the Marine Corps and for the Naval War College on various issues. So from that comes all of his writings that remain remarkably prescient even today. As for his status amongst people like Alfred Thayer Mahan and William Sims, he was an innovator. Well, there's two ways of looking at it. There's geographically and time period-wise, and then what they actually did in their career. In the first place, they all revolved around the Naval War College in this period of time in the early 20th century. Pete Ellis is actually a classmate of William Sims and then a co-instructor. They were both on the instruction staff at the same time at the Naval War College and knew each other. And So they had that in common. And then what they all did was intellectual innovation. You know, they weren't strictly inventors of any new technology or any new military capability. But what they did was take a look at what existed and figured out how to use it in the best way possible and what existing capability would need to be expanded and refigured for future warfare.
One of the things about him, and I think you identified it in the preface to the book perhaps, is that he's kind of considered the father of amphibious warfare for the Marines. Can you, you know, he came along after the disaster for the Allies in Gallipoli, and he observed, you know, or somebody he at least read about the activities of the Japanese and the Russians and other areas. Could you kind of go through how he developed his interest in amphibious warfare and why he's considered the father of it in the Marine Corps?
Well, along with every Marine, he's professionally interested in amphibious warfare and how to get it done. But prior to Pete Ellis, it really wasn't codified. Even in the Marine Corps and other Marines around the world, it was their primary job to conduct beach landings. It really was just get off the boat and go. There wasn't a whole lot of thought about how to do it besides, you know, getting off the boat, assaulting the shore, and taking it to the enemy directly. And what he did was really look at, took a deep study of how amphibious warfare should be conducted with modern tools and modern technology for his time. The standard method of doing it, getting off the boat and going, was conducted by the Athenians in the Peloponnesian War. And up until Pete Ellis' time, it hadn't been codified in the way that we are familiar with it today. And he did all that work at the Naval War College. He lectured on it. He wrote on it. And then General Lejeune, when he was commandant, pretty much took that forward and said, this is how the Marine Corps is going to do it. Later innovators, after Pete Ellis' death, used his work to produce the landing manual that was used by both the Navy and the Army in World War II. So way ahead of his time, he laid down the foundations that they would use to win that war.
I think one of the great points, and, you know, again, one of the instrumental foundation reasons for this series is looking back at personalities in our past and how applicable they are today. And I think he demonstrates, I think, a great feature of the Navy and Marine Corps, and I'm sure the other services as well, is there is enough white space for intellectual late bloomers, people that may not since eighth grade have conspired to get into an Ivy League school and had done all the right things as before they were adults, to be able to set themselves up. But there's a very good example in Ellis's history of one being a late bloomer, but the catalyst to that was what we would now call mentoring. Is there was a senior person up the chain that saw his potential and got him on the way to the War College. If you could touch on how that worked for him, and how in many ways Ellis was not just a normal guy showing up at Newport to get a wicket check out of the way.
A lot of his career was shaped by mentoring even from the beginning. When he entered the Marine Corps, he entered as an enlisted Marine out of Iuka, Kansas, with a high school education. And that's all he had. And someone very early on identified him. We don't know who that person is, but identified him as a remarkably intelligent recruit, demanded that he take the officer examination. In the course of studying for that examination, he hired a retired Army colonel in the Washington, D.C. area who tutored him on the test. And when he finally took it, he passed and was commissioned as a second lieutenant. From that point on, he served in the Philippines and interacted with John Archer Lejeune, who was, I believe, a captain at the time, who would go on to become the his biggest mentor and commandant of the Marine Corps. After his service in the Philippines, he went to headquarters Marine Corps as a staff officer because he showed the skills that would make him successful in that billet. And the commandant at the time, General George Barnett, identified him as a brand new captain as smart enough to go to the Naval War College as a student. And, one of the first Marines to do so. There were some other Marines that went in the same year as him. And he went there, and he was so successful as a student at the Naval War College that they kept him on for the very next year as an instructor. And the same situation happened with William Sims at the same time, of course. William Sims was a little bit senior Pete Ellis, but they obviously, since they were both instructors, they would interact kind of peers at that time. So after the Naval War College, every time John Lejeune had a chance to pull Pete Ellis somewhere in the world, he did so. And from that point on, as General Lejeune rose up the ranks, he pulled Pete Ellis with him. He pulled him to back onto the headquarters Marine Corps staff. When World War I came along, he sent Pete Ellis first to kind of prepare the ground for him and then pulled him all over Europe, everywhere the general went. After World War I, he pulled him right back to headquarters Marine Corps when General Lejeune became commandant. And that's where Lejeune put him to work on how to beat the Japanese from a Marine Corps perspective. Everywhere he went, he managed to find a mentor of some kind. Even later on, he kept in touch with Admiral Sims. Admiral Sims, when he went back to the Naval War College, turned down, but the attempt was made at least. So it was pretty remarkable in an age where mentorship is very important in the military, but not as easily practiced because of the personnel policy. That his whole career was basically determined by his mentors.
Yeah, I thought one of the more interesting aspects of the book was the section you put in there on his tour of duty as a staff officer in World War One. First thing is it's funny. I mean, he wrote it quite wittily, and the second thing is he suffered from the same thing we suffer from now, and I don't know if we solved the issue at all, but a total overdose of information, a lot of it useless. Could you kind of walk through that a little bit about his experience as a staff officer in World War One?
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest point to take from that chapter of the book, because a lot of the ways he dealt with that overflow of information really wouldn't apply today, but it's more so as a warning that too much information can overwhelm a staff. So the funniest part of the book, at least that chapter, is how he has to deal with all this information coming from sources like messenger dogs, messenger pigeons, getting overtasked and oversaturated as a staff with all that information. And I think a good point to take from that is that command and control is really the issues surrounding it, and how to get command and control done doesn't change just because of the technology does. I know we call it information management these days, and that's a part of command and control. But just because you have a computer doesn't necessarily mean you're more efficient if that computer is just feeding you too much information.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Did you catch all that?
Yeah, it sure did. It just got a little spotty towards the end. Just want to make sure we didn't drop sync. When you were looking at where he was in World War One, when he did the little staff tour, I found what was interesting in as kind of either a note or a warning in many regards that junior or mid, you know, the whole discussion about the strategic corporal, so to speak, but even mid-grade officers, when you're given tasking, can have a huge impact on the larger movements of troop materials and events. And you mentioned there briefly the fact that, he was sent over to Europe to basically tell his boss what was going on there. Pull the thread a little bit on that and describe how what Ellis saw when he was over there, how he communicated that, and what action his boss took based upon his reports and the, knock-on effect that had for how the Marine Corps functioned in the First World War.
The biggest issue that Pete Ellis got sent by General Lejeune to the Western Front, basically to talk to Pershing and General John Pershing and figure out what was going on with the Marines that were already arriving to see it. And what he found that was that the Army was basically training to enter the trenches and start to take the fight to the Germans, and the Marines were being used for very menial tasks. There wasn't really any intent to get the Marines on the ground and fighting as a fighting force. So the way he communicated that back was he went all the way back to the United States, told Lejeune exactly what he had seen. At that point, Lejeune ran over there, sailed over there, got over there as fast as he could. He brought Ellis with him and went right to General Pershing himself and basically made the case that these Marines are here not to just do menial tasks around the base camp there at the point of debarkation, but they were there to fight, and they needed to do so as a fighting unit of themselves. One of the issues they had to deal with was there were no Marine uniforms, so they had to wear Army uniforms. But they were going to the biggest thing the Marine Corps wanted to do was fight as a Marine unit under Army command. But just like the tension that General Pershing had with the Europeans, who wanted Americans to basically fill gaps in the line, he wanted Americans to stay and fight as an American Expeditionary Force. And he turned around and then wanted to use Marines just like the Europeans wanted to use Americans. And basically, Pete Ellis being a conduit between headquarters Marine Corps and what was going on at the front allowed the Marine Corps to send in some heavier hitters to change that. And General Lejeune did such a good job that the Marine Corps, of course, fought as Marine units alongside Army units. And then impressed General Pershing so much that when General Pershing needed a division commander, he made General Lejeune a commander of an Army division that had two Army brigades and a Marine brigade. Kind of rare in Marine Corps history to have a Marine in command of Army units, at least at that time.
One of the, I think one of the things that plays off that, though, is that after the war, and we're seeing it now after during our most recent adventures, the question keeps getting asked: why do we have Marine Corps? What are they for? Why don't we just fold these guys into the Army? And part of Ellis's job is, you know, I think as he saw it, perhaps, and maybe as Lejeune saw it, was to answer that question. Is my perception about that right? Or is that one of the missions he undertook? Justify the existence of the Corps?
Yeah, it was, and at the same time, redefining its role. And there was talk at the time of folding the Marine Corps into the Army or just making them sailors and having sailors tasked with conducting Marine assault. And they really needed to work on what a modern Marine Corps would look like. And the whole third chapter of the book is his ideas on a modern amphibious force, what it should look like, how it should operate. And I think through his recommendations for how a modern amphibious force should look really justified actually having a modern amphibious force. You know, the Gallipoli disaster, when the Army was convinced that amphibious assaults were impossible, in the interwar period, especially the Army War College. And Pete Ellis, through his work at the Navy War College, not only justified that amphibious assaults would be possible in the future, but exactly how to do it, down down to the amount of supplies that each regiment would need to do the job. And that's the detailed staff work that he conducted, even as an intellectual exercise, is far more than the British Expeditionary Force even bothered to do at the Gallipoli campaign, which is one of the explanations for why they didn't quite pull it off.
You mentioned one of the primary lessons that came away from the Gallipoli operation, and many times it is that experience and that understanding of how the Gallipoli campaign influenced the interwar period development of our own amphibious operations. What were some of the other takeaways that Ellis took away from the First World War that helped inform his work after the war in helping to develop that amphibious concept of operations?
Well, I think the major influence on his thinking was the experiments conducted by the Navy and the Marine Corps in Puerto Rico when they actually did live amphibious assaults in a training environment. And he was basically tasked with organizing the Marine Corps portion of that and had to figure out how to do it in order to get that training exercise done, and turned it around, did some staff churn on it, and figured it laid out how it would happen in real life. Another of the influences, I think, on his amphibious thinking, he studied the previous amphibious operations of Japan and Germany, both countries who he thought that we were going to fight in the future. Even before our involvement in World War One, he said we're going to have to fight Japan and Germany at some point. So he looked at how they did things and took a lot of their experiences on board and turned around a product of how he thought amphibious operations should be done. And the major discovery I had when reading through that stuff was that he basically invented a modern magtag. He organized the ground combat element along with a command element for amphibious assaults, recommended how they should look, recommended a logistics combat element, and the only thing he was really missing was an aviation combat element. But of course, aviation was really in its infancy at the time. He recommended there should be aviation support, but didn't imagine a whole air combat element as part of his proto-MAGTAF. And I think World War One, I'm not sure how much influence that had on it, probably a lot in the command and control area, and since his whole article on World War One was about command and control. But I think probably he envisioned World War One type assaults as happening from ship to shore, and then took that experience on board and came up with how it should be done in the future.
I think the other thing I was impressed with, and you caught it in your book too, was his work as counter-revolutionaries, working in these small wars in the Philippines, and I would guess he had familiarity with what was going on in the Central America area. But his work seems to have captured what lessons from Sun Tzu and what Mao would say later on about the the revolutionary swimming in the lake of the people, or whatever the exact quote is. But how much experience did he actually have with it? I mean, and can you kind of talk about lessons he learned that we still have to learn today, or we had to relearn over and over again that in our adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan?
So Pete Allen served, his major formative experience when he came to counterinsurgency was his service in the Philippines. And he served two tours of duty there, both over a year long. I can't remember the years off the top of my head. I want to say it was 1903 to 1905 and 1907 to like 1911. So long tours of duty in the Philippines while we were trying to establish control over insurgency in that country. Of course, our involvement began in 1898 in the Philippines, but he was there for really the counterinsurgency phase and not so much the getting involved in the country phase. So a lot of veterans probably really relate to that. Like, I myself missed the march up to Iraq, but then was I was involved on a transition team in the counterinsurgency phases of Great Deal. So he really had a similar situation when it came to counterinsurgency. And some of the ideas he came up with are really even more familiar to today's veterans. He recommended prudent use of fire support, especially in urban areas. He recommended fortified posts all around the country, like what we would call FOBs, and a heavy use of patrolling to kind of hunt down those the insurgents. He referred to as flying columns, along with which was the term of the time. And then I think his most important point was at the tactical level, the importance of strategic clarity on the part of the national authority. In the Philippines, there was a proclamation of occupation that President McKinley issued in 1898, basically laid out exactly what we were doing there, exactly what the troops were expected to do, and that was, to Pete Ellis's mind, something that needed to be done. It could prevent war crimes. It could keep morale high because they know they're there for a moral and ethical reason. And he laid out all the effects that this had at the tactical level. I think that's something we've really forgotten today. Possibly a result of the interjection or the operational level of war, but even at the corporal and lance corporal level, the justification for the war has an effect on the minds of the Marines and soldiers. They feel they're there for a good reason. They're more apt to make good choices in their tactics and the things they do in that country in the service of ours.
I want to pull a thread on that whole idea about counterinsurgency. And the Marine Corps, I remember right after 9/11, everybody's like, oh, what's this counterinsurgency thing? In spite of everything that was done and learned in Vietnam, at least the Army institutionally decided they didn't want to forget about that. And one of the common points of discussion, like, well, the Marine Corps still has this little thing about small wars. They still look about it. What can we learn from the Marines? So from a counterinsurgency point of view, and Ellis was part of that, there was still a nucleus of that type of thinking and planning inside the Marine Corps. And we're seeing right now in the Army that they've decided that they want to forget about counterinsurgency again. And we're seeing the Coindonistas, as people disparaging like to call them, against your traditional arms, who are really excited about what's going on in Eastern Europe right now. Question I have for you is, counterinsurgency, small wars, small conflicts, punitive expeditions, things of that manner, inside the Marine Corps of 2015, is there a similar battle going on that we see in the Army between those that want to maintain not just the intellectual effort, but the material and training aspects of being able to conduct counterinsurgency versus those that want to wish it away and would rather go back to what is called traditional warfare fighting areas? How is that intellectual discussion taking place in the Marine Corps?
I'm not all that familiar with what's going on inside the Army, but that same discussion that you mentioned is taking place in the Marine Corps, and basically deciding what we're going to look like in the future, and not so much whether we're going to do counterinsurgency or whether we're going to do major combat operations, but what the mix is going to be, 50-50, 60-40, 90-10, or basically what kind of emphasis we should put on both. And the Marine Corps is kind of fortunate that we've got the Marine Corps Gazette, where all this stuff plays out and you can look at every month. There's only really one intellectual magazine for the whole Marine Corps, and that's the Gazette. In the Army, they've got, like, each branch has their own. There's a Fiery Bulletin, there's Armor, there's the Infantry Journal, I think, is still around. So that really, I think that has a way of fragmenting the discussion or part of the problem. But the Marine Corps is very easy to follow. And what that discussion basically is whether wars are going to look like Iraq and Afghanistan, or whether they're going to look like the march up in Persian Gulf. And there's both sides almost every month. There's an article taking one side or the other. And as for Expeditionary Force 21, for example, the Marine Corps' most recent white paper on the future, it basically doesn't take a side. That we've got to be ready for both, and that's typical of a quick response force. But down at the unit level, I think there's a pretty big push to go back before that counterinsurgency stuff. And I can't speak for every unit, but I think there's a lot of tension between where we're going to go. And I'm not sure how that's going to play out, and frankly, I'm not sure where it should play out at this point. Haven't quite made up my mind. I do know we can't get rid of our small wars background and our institutional knowledge, but how much we're going to use it, I'm not willing to come down with both feet on one side yet. I will mention Pete Ellis's involvement in that. He died in 1923, and the major institutional work for the Marine Corps when it comes to small wars is the Small Wars Manual, first issued in 1938, and I want to say it was redone in 1940. That's still read today. It still makes all the recommended reading lists today, and a lot of his ideas are in it. Now, whether that was transmitted from Pete Ellis to the Small Wars Manual just through other people who saw the same things that he did, or whether they read his article in the Gazette and used it when they were compiling all those lessons in the late 1930s, I don't think we'll ever know. Obviously, he didn't participate in writing the Small Wars Manual itself. But it was interesting to see that all the Small Wars ideas that are typical of the Marine Corps were really emblematic in his article that I dug up, even though it was published so long before the Small Wars Manual. So obviously whatever the Marine Corps was doing to retain those lessons from the early 1920s to the late 1930s, they were doing it right. And I can hope we're doing the same thing today.
Yeah, I thought that article had so much in it that this is Ellis's article that you put in the book that it was just fun to read because he talks about everything. He talks about human terrain mapping. He talks about the value of quality of intelligence, the value of good actionable intelligence instead of he has a pretty funny thing about. I can't remember the exact quote, but something about mutterings overheard in a bar. And I thought that was really interesting stuff. I guess he would face the same thing as Sal just said that we're facing today. I mean, the balancing act between the small wars and the bigger wars, but the luggage that carries as far as the Navy is concerned is that we provide the ships to get the Marines to go do whatever it is they're going to do. Is there a discussion about the future? I'm sure there is, about the discussion of amphibious warfare today that's as strong as what Ellis was coming up with back in those days? Or, are people looking at this and going, there's no way we'll ever do that again? I mean, I know we get that discussion a lot on our side. What are the Marines saying about that?
There's definitely not a whole lot of we're never going to do that again in the Marine Corps, I think. We teach our young candidates and recruits about all the people that were wrong when they said there'll never be an amphibious assault again. So it's just not something they want to get burned with after they go through all the classes at Parris Island and Quantico. But there is a discussion on how that's going to look and really whether it's going to be a more aviation heavy, whether it's going to be surface connector heavy, and that's the big thing, especially with the cancellation of the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle. The question isn't whether we're going to have to assault the beach or whether we're going to do it. It's how we're going to do it when we get there, and when we're faced with it. And a lot of the planning exercises we do at PME schools, like Expeditionary Warfare School, and a lot of the training exercise out at 29 Palms, and even the East Coast artillery exercise, Rolling Thunder, they're all amphibious focused. There's always an amphibious component to the plan, even if it's simulated and even if it's just done in planning and not done on the deck in real life. So there's not really an existential crisis when it comes to whether to do amphibious assault. We're always trying to figure out how to do it and whatever's going on. And in this day and age, I don't think it could be more important, especially with tensions with China and all the islands in the Pacific. And this brings us right back to Pete Ellis. To his mind, the key to control the Pacific was control of the island. And I don't think we quite recognize, outside of the Marine Corps anyway, how important those islands will be in any conflict in the Pacific. I think the only ones that understand it as much as the Marines are the Chinese, and they understand it so well they're building new islands to control that water, which is something we haven't got around to doing quite yet.
And that is a perfect lead into the question I was just about to ask, so thank you very much for reading my mind. One of the things that drives me nuts, and I think anybody who studies history probably gets a twitch when people say this, is when people will just in a very blanket way say, well, that will never happen again. Because when you look back into history, you can see technology and personalities change, but the challenges pretty much are the same. And specifically when we're looking at how does one conduct and project national will across long distances in contested seas? Nowadays with China and other technologies, whether you're talking about anti-ship ballistic missiles or supersonic anti-ship cruise missiles, et cetera, and so forth, or even the old technology mines, the argument is always made, well, because of that, this is never going to happen. And I think it's what's really neat in the work you edited here is to read what Ellis had to say decades before when people would make the argument, you can't do it, yet afterwards it was done over and over again. And just if you don't mind me quoting at length here, just to give people a taste of why, if they haven't already, to go get the book. If you look in his article, Naval Bases, Their Location, Resources, and Security, this is 1911-1912, over a century ago. We have a point that he makes right here. I'm going to the bottom of page 62. The increased costliness and vulnerability of ships, again from 1911-1912, beginning of a long quote, naval materiel in the main is unreplaceable in war. It is the only military element that can destroy naval material properly used. Naval material is also particularly costly and vulnerable. While it takes an army to destroy an army, one man and one mine may be used to destroy a battleship. When a battleship makes a hit on a multi-million-dollar shore battery, except in rare cases, it only destroys what it hits. When a shore battery makes a hit on a $15 million battleship, it destroys what it hits plus anything up to $15 million worth. Their chances are not bad for the limit. To make matters worse, a shore battery, gun for gun, can make more hits. For the reasons it is extremely wasteful to hazard modern ships in a contest with coast fortifications, unless the chances are good that such action will result indirectly in a corresponding reduction of enemy floating naval strength. In the present day, again, 1911-1912, it is not likely that serious attempt would be made to force an entrance into or closely attack a well-defended port, although feints may be made by second-class ships in the execution and demonstration intended to keep the sea defense occupied while the landing is attempted. In general, even when a nation has considerable naval supremacy, until the sea contest is decided, naval power must be husbanded for legitimate use, the destruction of floating sea power. End of long quote. technology has changed. Perhaps he's thinking about different countries. But you were talking about China and their first island chain, second island chain, and their sandcastles they're building as well. If we could reanimate Pete Ellis and keep him away from the bar for a couple of weeks, if we explain to him the challenge we're looking at in the Pacific, what do you think he would want to point us towards what we need to focus on and think about here in 2015 based upon what he knew back in 1911, 1912?
Well, I think he, with great relish, he would point us right in advanced-based operations in Micronesia, which is included in the book. Basic idea of that is that you need to control the island in order to get across that body of water, and the Navy, which he was very much a Mahanian thinker. He viewed the Navy as something that needed to be there to fight the enemy Navy. They needed bases out there for support. And now back then it was because they needed coaling stations so they could move. We don't need coal today, but we still need stations for those ships to go to rearm, refit, and to defend themselves. Because what he noticed is that one man with one bomb can take out a multi-million-dollar naval vessel. That danger has only grown today. You know, the USS Cole proves that, and the terrorist attack on that. Even taking a bigger view of it, anytime you're going to transition a Navy across a long period of long distance and project power somewhere, you need intermediate bases to fall back on in case something happens, or even to just make the going easy. So I'll take you back even further than 1911, 1912, and mention the Peloponnesian War again, the Athenian expedition to Sicily. After they had a naval disaster there in the Straits of Messina, if they had an intermediate base to fall back on, maybe they could have given that one another try, and their army wouldn't have been isolated on the island of Sicily. But that just speaks to Pete Ellis' point. I think if we had him back and out of the O Club for a little while to dry out, that's exactly what he'd say. Naval projection is one of the most difficult things a nation or a military can do. And you need to do it in a smart and deliberate manner if you're going to make it work.
Yeah, I have in my notes here, I wrote down Mahan, Sims, Ellis, and I wrote down forward deployment. And it seems to me that one of the lessons that, and you're talking about these islands in the Pacific, those of us who've enjoyed a three-week transit across the Pacific on board a ship know how big that ocean is. Forward deployment. We've got Prepo ships out there. We've got Marines in Okinawa. I think I can't remember what the percentage of the Marine Corps is actually deployed to the Pacific, but it's a huge number relative to the size of the force. And, you know, we're going to put some on Guam, as I understand, if that island doesn't fall over when we put them there. So this forward deployment concept that I wrote down, was that in Ellis's thinking? Is that where I grabbed that? Because that's sure what I was hit me as I was reading through this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. He was focused on how, and even not just the United States. You know, he was mostly writing on how the United States could do this. But when he looked at Japan and Germany as potential opponents, he believed that we were going to have to fight Japan over control of the Pacific, and that they were going to project their forces into the island. They were going to, at some point, conduct a surprise attack on us, and then we were going to have to project power back into those islands, seize control, and then use that to win the war. So basically all his thinking was focused on forward deployment, especially naval forward deployment, or Navy-facilitated forward deployment of troops. When he looked at Germany, he thought he really nailed the Japan portion. I stumbled a little bit with Germany. He said we were going to fight them, but he said we were going to fight them over control of the Caribbean. And they were going to use their Navy, which was growing at the time, to project force into the Caribbean, and we were going to have to take it back from them and then use the Caribbean as a springboard to win the war from there. Didn't quite play out that way. But I think one out of two isn't bad in that regard.
I don't want to get towards the end of the hour before I didn't bring up something that you know, maybe help some of your peers who are interested in something and really want to write about a topic that they're enthusiastic about. I wonder if we could just take a few minutes and have you describe the process you came to grab hold of Ellis as a subject for research, and also talk a bit about that gloriously underused treasure that is the Marine Corps Archive at the Marine Corps base in Quantico. Because as a museum geek and an archive geek, when I saw that, I just put a big smile on my face. I knew exactly what you're talking about. So talk a little bit about what resources actually are available out there, especially for people who are used to doing all their research online, that there are some great places that can have surprising amounts of information.
My experience with the Marine Corps Archive goes back. I was a student at EWS in 2003, and you get a tour of the library when you come to be a student there because you're expected to do non-internet research. So you get taken over to the library, and you get a little tour of the archive. And, you know, I've been a writer. At that point, I've been a writer, amateur researcher for a number of years. And one project I still haven't completed, but I started way back then, is to really look at Boyd's Clausewitz on war and really see where these two military thinkers agreed and where they disagreed. And the way I was able to do that, being stationed at Quantico and having access to the archive, was I could pull out of the Marine Corps archive John Boyd's copy of On War. And I could sit there in the archives and flip through it and look at all of his handwritten notes on every page. So I could basically be a fly on the wall of these two dead men having a meeting of the mind, and just like flipping through that copy of On War and all John Boyd's handwritten notes. So that was really, I still need to finish that project. I started there. But I'll get around to it one of these days, because there's a lot in those notes. But that's an example of what's in there. And then when B.J. Armstrong published 21st Century Mahan, you know, I contacted him on Twitter and said, someone ought to take a look at Pete Ellis. I bet there's a lot of stuff in the archives somewhere that you could pull out of there and do a book on him. And he put me in touch with the publisher, and the publisher was like, why don't you do it? And now I did. I contacted the archives. By that point, I was stationed at Camp Lejeune. I talked to an archivist up there, and I said, hey, here's a project I'm looking at, and here's what I need. And literally about an hour and 45 minutes later, I had a PDF copy of every word that Ellis had ever written in my email box. And that's the core of the book. So, and they were happy to do so. They don't give from what they told me, they don't get enough visitors up there. These guys are professionals up there. They're not just random people off the street charged with looking after the archive. They're very professional, very talented archivists, and they are just as happy as they can be to help anyone who just wants to take a look. So if anyone's intellectually curious out there, I'd encourage you to stop by. The Marine Corps Archive, it is inside the Gray Research Center aboard Marine Corps Base Quantico. And those are just two things I found there, and there's really a whole lot more if you want to spend the time up there.
I don't think we gave you the chance at the start of the show to give the standard disclaimer about your thoughts on the show being your own and not those of the Marine Corps, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to give you that chance now. But is one of the concerns that if I were an up-and-coming Marine Corps officer that I would have is that there aren't sufficient number of amphibs, and if there aren't enough amphibs, there aren't enough ships to escort them into harm's way. Is the size of the Navy of concern to an up and coming Marine?
Okay. All right. So I'll start out with that disclaimer. All the thoughts contained here in this podcast are officially my own and enjoy no agreement on the part of the United States Marine Corps or the Department of Navy or the Department of Defense. None of them listen to me at all. So all these thoughts are my own. As for the amphib issue, yes, I think all Marines are concerned with the number of amphibs because as relevant as we think we are, if the Navy and specifically Congress that provides the funds for all these ships don't agree that we're relevant in that capacity, then we'll fast become irrelevant just because the ships won't be there. You know, it has a lot to do with our very healthy propaganda system in the Marine Corps, but every Marine officer, I think, is a little concerned with the number of ships, and it's kind of shocking to see the USS America without a well deck. I think we're most of us are okay with that. I think there's one more without a well deck coming, especially when it comes to ground capabilities and ground officers, the only way we have of getting from ship to shore is to use a well deck or be carried by the aviation combat element. So, yeah, that's a big concern, though. Well, I think it's not enough of a concern is in the U.S. Army. I also don't represent any views on their part, if anyone's listening. But it's a well-known fact, and Nate Finney will remind me of this every chance he gets, but the U.S. Army has done more amphibious assaults than the United States Marine Corps. And I think that there's a possibility that they may have to again. If Marine forces can't be moved from one place to another in time for an amphibious assault, they may be right there next to us during an amphibious assault. But not if there's no amphibious ship. So I think there's a big concern to guys. Both the Marine Corps as an expeditionary force and the Army expeditionary force as well. That without those ships, we lose a lot of options. And even though any amphibious assault in the modern day will be a combination of both surface connectors and aviation assault support to get those troops to shore, that you're really cutting out a lot of options if there aren't ships available to get those troops close enough to get ashore.
In the short elevator speech on Ellis, one of the bold-faced items that always comes out is, speaking of outspoken and intellectually aggressive officers, he's often credited with being very prescient about Japan and World War II. And at the time, how was that received, his views, and how were they incorporated into War Plan Orange?
I'm not really sure how wider society really viewed his ideas on Japan and Germany. Obviously, General Lejeune was a fan, because he enacted many of his recommendations as Commandant of the Marine Corps. And when it came to War Plan Orange, I think in the early phases, the Naval War College was really tasked with putting together the foundation of the plan, even in the early 1920s. And someone at the Naval War College obviously was aware of who Pete Ellis was, and this was the time period that Sims asked for him, so it may have been the connection with the plans to work on War Plan. But when it came down to it, the Commandant of the Marine Corps was assigned to do the Marine Corps portion of War Plan Orange, and that Commandant was General Lejeune. So he assigned it to his preferred staff officer of many years, Pete Ellis. I describe it in the book a little bit. It gets described in his biography a lot more. But he basically sat at Headquarters Marine Corps in Washington, D.C. and worked on this thing day and night by himself. to the detriment of his health. He had to be hospitalized in the middle of it because he was working so hard on it, you know, probably drinking at the same time. So, but even, he finished his portion, gave that to General Lejeune, who approved it in, I want to say, 1923. But that was also the same year Fidel has died. So after he handed off his magnum opus, if you will, to General Lejeune, that was his involvement from then on. It was all on paper due to his early death. But I think, even looking at the history of World War II, you can see his ideas were still present even after the intervening two decades. And I mentioned this in the book, I believe, that the island, one of the islands, which the name escapes me right now, he predicted that Japan would take it and that we would take it back. And then we'd do so with four regiments of Marine infantry. Like, that's how much it would take to take the island. And that's exactly how that battle played out over 20 years after his death. And that's, it's hard to imagine anyone getting more prescient than that. I know Sir Michael Howard is fond of saying that we can't predict the next war, but Pete Ellis did it. I'm not sure if anyone else has ever been better at it than he was.
Well, that we're talking about his health and how he died. I mean, you know, this is not really covered. I mean, it's in your book, but it's not really one of the topics he wrote about, obviously. But his death is kind of a mystery. I mean, as I understand it, he went out to the Pacific and was visiting some islands, and he allegedly resigned his commission and so forth. What about that?
Yeah.
I mean, what's your view of what was behind that? Was he out there on a spying run, or was something else going on?
Well, he was clearly out there on a spy run. He was clearly spying on the Japanese. But whether that spying mission was officially sanctioned or whether a product of just himself, I don't think we'll ever know. All we know is that before he left, whether it was at General Lejeune's behest or not, he left a blank resignation of his commission with General Lejeune, and all that Lejeune had to do was sign, and his commission was officially resigned in case he never came back, which he didn't. He went to a series of islands that were controlled by Japan at the time, all of which had military fortifications that they were working on, and he was taking notes on those military fortifications. So that really was what he was doing out there. And described much better in his biography, but he wasn't the best spy because the Japanese certainly knew exactly what he was doing. And on the final island he made it to, the Japanese, the local the director of the local Japanese police decided to give him two bottles of Jack Daniels whiskey, which was his favorite. So the Japanese intel guys knew pretty much everything about Pete Ellis. They knew his favorite type of whiskey, and they had those two bottles delivered. And Pete Ellis drank both bottles in one evening, and sometime in the night expired as a result of drinking those two bottles. Now, whether that was the intent of the Japanese or whether they just wanted to make him a gift and scare him a little or just get him drunk, we'll never know, I don't think. But that was the end of Pete Ellis's personal story there. And all we have left is his intellectual gift.
Well, it was a good gift and a good legacy. As we're wrapping things up, Brent, let me try to rephrase this. What are your thoughts on the reception you've received for 21st Century Ellis? I mean, are you anything surprising you've found out or feedback you've gotten? And also, what are you working on next?
Well, the feedback I've gotten so far is that the book is selling well. So that's much appreciated by anyone who's bought it out there. Of course, I had the ground prepared very well for me by B.J. Armstrong publishing the first two books. And obviously, creating this opportunity for me, although inadvert it may have been, he was also great help writing it, giving me advice on how to go about how to research and how to go through the publishing, which is something I never had any experience with. As for feedback, it seems like a lot of people liked the excerpt that was on War on the Rocks recently. I got a lot of feedback on that, and I'm just pretty happy that this project came to fruition. As for what I'm working on next you'll see from me on the Bridge, Nate Finney's blog. On April 24th, I have a very long post on Gallipoli and my thoughts on it. And that will be posted Friday, April 24th, which is the day before the 100th anniversary of the ANZAC British Expeditionary Force landing. So I'm pretty excited about that. Hopefully I have some original thoughts on it. And it's kind of a pay on to those Marines and soldiers that have gone before me and landed on that awful shore on the 100th anniversary.
Well, I look forward to reading it, Brett. And, hey, really appreciate you taking time this afternoon to come out and join us for the full hour.
Yeah, thanks very much. I had a great time.
Enjoyed it.
And thank you very much, everybody who joined us today. Please join us again next week for another live show of MidRat, where our guest will be Vice Admiral Moran, Chief of Naval Personnel. Until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
It's a long way to Tipperary.